This is Klaatu, and you're listening to episode 8 of season 5 of Bad Apples, GNU Linux, Og and Speaks cast. Hi everyone, like I say, my name is Klaatu, this is the Bad Apple GNU Linux Og and Speaks cast. Rumors of me getting rid of the Speaks feed are completely and wildly incorrect. I don't know how these rumors got started. Oh, actually, yes, I do. I said I was going to do that. Well, luckily, I've had some sense talked into me by a lot of different people. And, I mean, the people are kind of typical because they're the ones who are in IRC, so they talk to me a lot. One person was in Australia, and he did point out that, you know, when you've got bandwidth, I guess you would say throttling or a limit, you know, like a quota, I guess. The difference between an 8 meg OGG file and 3.6 or 4 meg Speaks file actually does make a difference. So that was a good point. And then a couple of other people just thought it was kind of cool that I was supporting the Speaks cause as well as the OGG cause. So they were just kind of like encouraging me to continue doing that rather than just drop the Speaks feed. So I'm going to not drop the Speaks feed. And frankly, you know, after everyone had kind of mentioned it to me, I just so happened, completely coincidentally, I was at a computer somewhere and I just needed something really quick. And so I went to Deep Geek's site and I downloaded one of his episodes, and it just goes so fast. It's unbelievable. And yeah, I think there is. I mean, there's an obvious difference between 3.4 megabytes or whatever and 8 or 11 megabytes. And you look at it and you think, well, there's not that much of a difference. And yeah, there's not. But it does make a difference when you're sitting down and you just want something really, really fast. And those Speaks files, I mean, I'm telling you, it's a joke. They're just on your computer. Like, you blink and they're there. So it's worth it. So I'm keeping the Speaks feed. Now, if you're one of the eager, excited people, you know, subscribing to the Speaks feed, all three or four of you, which actually is a pretty big percentage of my listenership if you think about it. That's like 1/8 or something. So for those people subscribing to the Speaks feed, just know that the Speaks feed has its own music. Because obviously, music in Speaks doesn't quite usually work all that well. So I have really basic, like, MIDI-fied Vivaldi music, and not much of it, and there's no point at which the music overlaps the voice, because that's a little bit complex for Speaks to handle. And also, I don't have the coffee break in the Speaks feed. So you probably have gotten very used to the coffee break that I typically have in the OGG feed. But again, the music is just not going to quite work in the Speaks feed. And so I don't do that. So that could be a feature for some people, or a bug that completely kills the possibility of listening to Speaks for others. I'm not really sure which. But the coffee break is not in the Speaks feed. So, you know, it's not that I've actually dropped it. If you're listening to the Speaks feed and you think I've totally changed the music and gotten rid of the coffee break, that's not the case. It's just you're listening to the poor man's feed, and so that's all you get. Okay, so this episode we're going to talk about, actually, a little bit about Speaks, some tests that I've done on Speaks, and I'm also going to talk about some of the email issues that I've experienced, which luckily have not actually been all that bad. They were bad for a couple of days, but it turned out to be a completely non-email-related issue. I mean, it was email-related, but I mean, it wasn't because of the setup or anything. It was something else, and I'll go into what that was. And we'll also talk about setting up an FTP server. So let's get started. So switching around the whole email system for myself, as I was doing since the episode before last episode, 2 episodes ago, I've been kind of taking it slowly. I mean, I didn't want to pimp out Mutt too much, you know. I wanted to just keep it plain vanilla, just so I could get used to the way this whole email process was happening. I'm kind of ready to start screwing around with Mutt a little bit more. So I will be checking out Cafe Ninja's Mutt config file and other people's config file to see options are out there. I definitely need an easier way to switch between what we would think as folders, you know, like, because in Mutt, when you check your email or check it with FetchMail, and that pulls all the messages down, and then you go into Mutt and look at the messages. When you quit, it offers to move all the messages that you've read to your inbox, that is M as in mail and then box, and you can say yes or you can say no. I say yes, and so it shuffles it off to this big inbox text file. And you don't see them again in your main view because that's kind of like your incoming view. So in order to get to the inbox, what I've been doing since I've had a really, really basic config file is just doing mutt-m inbox-f /inbox because that's where I've got the inbox. So that's working, and it works quite well. It's just kind of weird, you know, and I'm pretty sure I'm not supposed to be doing it that way. So I'm going to figure that kind of thing out. But in fact, it's this inbox that was giving me an issue. And what I'd done was I'm trying to consolidate all my accounts so that I really only have two accounts, which is what I've done. So I've got one account that lives on the Kernel Panic Ogcast.net server, and all my other addresses simply forward to that, with the exception of my gort.klaatu@gmail.com account. I know you're thinking, Gmail? I thought you hated Google. Well, I do, but Gmail has all my mailing lists and stuff subscribed to that. That's kind of my junk account and my mailing list account. So while I don't want to be on Google, I also loathe the idea of getting all those mailing lists transferred over to a different place. So I'm kind of putting that off until I have time to manage that sort of thing. So aside from this, those are the two accounts. But like I say, the Gmail one is very specific to basically just email account or to mailing lists, and just when I post comments on blogs or sign up for a service that I think I'm going to need to know, you know, I want to have contact with that service, but I don't want to have daily contact with it. So I just put my Gmail in. It's not quite junk, but it's that kind of public-facing email that you figure is going to start getting a lot of spam at some point. Whereas my other accounts, the other addresses that I have, I don't post anywhere. And typically the only way people find those addresses is that they listen to this show with their human ears, and that's all. It's a little bit tougher for the spam bots to find that kind of thing. So anyway, I had accounts all over the place, and I knew that using the POP protocol, I could just go in with FetchMail and grab all the email messages off the server and dump them into a file on my local hard drive, which is what I did. So I set up FetchMail to use POP, and I issued the POP command, or the FetchMail command, and it went on to, for instance, Linux Cranks, which has been the home of a lot of the emails previously. And so I grabbed all the email off of that server and pulled it down to the local drive. And now Linux Cranks forwards to my new address, so don't go changing your address book if you don't want to. It's fine. It's still a good address. It's just not, the email isn't actually on that physical server now. I went in there, I grabbed all the email messages and dumped them onto my local drive into something I thought was going to be an inbox format, that is mailbox inbox format. For whatever reason, and I don't know the reason, that's not how it works. FetchMail, I guess, doesn't output to that automatically, or maybe not at all. Not really sure. It looks like what I'd understood an inbox file was. It read like one. You know, it was a big text file with like 4 million lines of text with all the headers and all the text of the message in there. But if I did a file inbox, it gave me something other than inbox format. It said it was 7-bit text, I think, or something like that. Something that was not inbox, apparently. Well, it turns out there's a little utility out there called Formail or Formmail. I'm not really sure how it's supposed to be said, of course, but it's Formail. And all you have to do to convert these weird default fetch mail entities, which we will call, let's just call it FooBar, okay? So all you have to do is do Formail space dash DS, that is Delta S. What is S? Stellar? I forget. But it's DS, as in, you know, like the Nintendo DS. DS. And then the less than symbol, FooBar, and then greater than, so we're redirecting the output into, for instance, well, inbox, as in im as in mail and in box. That will process it. That picks up all the little clues in the header files and stuff like that and parses it correctly and restructures it into a proper inbox format. And from then on, if you tell Mutt, hey, look at that inbox file, or append all my old read all the messages that I've just read, append that to that inbox file, Mutt is fine with it. It recognizes that as an inbox format file. It can redirect stuff to it. It can read from it and all that other good stuff. So to you, it's really kind of cool. To you, it's this big inbox format file. It's just this one big text file. But if you issue the mutt command with mutt space dash m, again is in mail, and I think the dash m stands for the mailbox type. So dash m, inbox, and then space dash f as in file, and then the name of the inbox. So I just call mine inbox. So I do mutt dash m inbox dash f inbox. Now if you had called your inbox, I don't know, your name, so clatu.inbox or something like that, then it would be mutt dash m inbox dash f clatu.inbox. That will open mutt in your terminal, but instead of looking at your spool file where your mail is coming in and stuff from fetch mail and proc mail, it's actually just looking at this inbox file, and you'll see all the messages there just parsed perfectly, just like you'd normally see it in Thunderbird or Kmail or whatever you're using, Claws, Silphied, whatever, Pine. So it's really interesting how this stuff works, and I was really having a hard time with this because I thought fetch mail had given me an inbox. And so if you have an issue with like trying to open up a file of a big bulk file of emails that you think might be an inbox, use formail-ds less than foobar greater than inbox.inbox, and that will fix it for you. About a year ago at work, I had set up an FTP server to share files among the department that I was working in, and it was a lot of fun. And I used VS FTP, and after I did that, if I recall correctly, it was around that same time, I did a little HPR episode on just kind of the basics of getting it set up. Now that I've done it more, and actually done it from home, I mean, obviously at work, it didn't really have to face the outside world, there wasn't a whole lot going on, it was not on a very complex setup, it was really just, I mean, it was an internal shared folder, basically, it wasn't that big of a deal. And I'm still quite the networking noob, so don't take everything I say as the best advice in the world. But what I've done lately is I set up an FTP server in my apartment here. When I say server, it's my old PowerBook G4 sitting on a box on the floor in the corner, plugged into the modem directly, and that's pretty much it. So it's nothing fancy, and it doesn't have to be anything fancy. It doesn't have to be a big jet engine server kind of deal. And I did this because I needed to get files from people halfway across the world. The KDE-Promo group, which is located roughly at wiki.kde.org. You can go into the community section of that, and you'll find all the KDE promo people and the KDE art people, I guess, and all that other good stuff. So they need some videos edited, and I volunteered to do that editing. So they needed to get me gigabytes and gigabytes of video files, and we were going back and forth about how to do this. One guy opened up an HTTP port and gave me the link, and I was going to download them, but for whatever reason I couldn't get them. My connection just kept dropping, my service kept dropping the connection. Could not get those things off of the server. So I was like, well, you know what? I just set up an FTP server at my new job, at one of my new jobs. I can probably do the same thing in my home. And indeed, this is the case. I took the server that Russ Winter from the Techie Geek podcast had given me at Ohio Linux Fest this past year, and I took that into work because they needed a server anyway, and threw Fedora 12 on there, and it's a big Dell server, PowerEdge, so I threw Fedora on there and just set it up as a server, basically, and it works quite nicely, but again, it's not outside world accessible. So for whatever reason, I figured doing this in my apartment and letting the world see it might not be a bad idea. So that's what I set about doing, and here's how we can do it. So I did this on my Fedora machine because that was the machine that was free, really. So I figured, why not do it on Fedora? I think NASA uses Fedora, so it must be an okay thing for a server. And I think it probably is. There is an issue with SE Linux that I do not understand enough to get around, and so I went and took perhaps a chainsaw to it, where a scalpel might have been more appropriate. The server at work, I was able to circumvent the SE Linux thing by adding a permission, kind of opening up a permission for the FTP access. But here at my apartment, I think I just got the command wrong. And since I wasn't at work where I'd written the command down, I didn't have access to that. So, okay, here's how we do it. Here's how to do this on Fedora. And it should be pretty much similar on anything, really. And it's really not half as hard as you might think. It's actually really quite easy. And I really have to thank the last known god for helping me out on this. And also Digzit really helped me out. So between those two guys in IRC kind of hitting the server and seeing if they could get in, they made it possible for this to all happen. So I thank both of them emphatically. And I'll send them both a Bad Apples GNU Linux Ogcast t-shirt. Not really, because I don't have any t-shirts, but I would if I had them. So here's how to do the whole FTP thing. So you need to install the FTP server software, which, just as in my HPR episode more than a year ago, the one that I figured would be easy to use, and I think I still agree, is VSFTP. That is Victor Sierra FTP. And you can install that quite easily in, really in anything. I mean, everyone's got that available pretty much, I think. But in Fedora, actually, you can do, I don't know if everyone knows about this little command, but it's called yum space group list, and then you can grep for something, or you can just do a group list. And it's quite nice, because what that does is there are groups set in Fedora. There are groups of installations that you can do in Fedora, so that if you sit down and say to yourself one day, gee, I really want the LXDE desktop installed, then you can do a yum group install LXDE, and that will take LXDE and all of its associated files and install it for you. Kind of nice. The group that you can install for the FTP stuff is simply called FTP server. Now, it's two words, so you're going to have to put that in quotes. So if you do yum group install, and that's all one word, so yum and then group install, one word, space, quote, FTP space server. And that's a capital F, a capital T, and a capital P, and then a capital S in front of that server. So if you do that, it will grab everything in the group called FTP server and install it. And if you want to find out, see, this really should be a Fedora Reloaded episode, obviously, but oh well. If you want to find out what's in that group, you can do yum space group info FTP server, again in quotes. And that will tell you exactly what's in the package, in the group. And one of the things in that group is the mandatory package itself is VSFTPD, and then the optional packages that it will install unless you tell it not to, with an exclude function, which I think is like dash X or something like that, is ProFTPD, PureFTPD, and ExfersStats. Now, admittedly, the optional packages you don't really need, and this is pretty much simple enough that you don't really need all that extra stuff. You could just do yum install VSFTPD, but I went ahead and took the whole FTP server package because I figured I might need it later on, or I might want to play around with other features or other FTP daemons or whatever. So I went ahead and did the whole group install. Plus, it's just good to tell you about the group option on yum, because that is kind of handy, especially for things like LXDE, because Pegwall actually got me onto, see, I said I wasn't going to drop names, and now here I am talking about all kinds of people, and I do apologize. I don't mean to make other people sound like I'm just talking about these people, but they're the ones in IRC a lot, and they're talking to me about stuff, so it's almost like listener feedback in a way. But anyway, someone got me into kind of turned me onto this LXDE thing, and I mean, obviously I'd heard of it, and I'd seen it on Canopic 6, and I was kind of interested in it, but not really. But then I tried LXDE on my Fedora, my PowerPC Fedora install, which has KDE as the main desktop, so I tried LXDE. And, I mean, the great thing about KDE is that you don't even need KDE as such. You can just use all those K apps, and it's just so great. The K apps are just hands down some of the best apps out there for computers at all. But LX Terminal's cool, too, so, I mean, you know, it's It's not like I have to have kapps. Point is, easy way to install LXDE on Fedora would be yum space group install LXDE. And if you didn't know that, you could do a yum space group list and then grep-i LXDE, and that would show you that the group name is indeed LXDE. So anyway, we've installed FTP, VSFTP now, right? And now that it's installed, you're basically ready to go, believe it or not. I know that sounds kind of weird, but, I mean, a lot of these things, and I never really knew this, I never understood this, but a lot of these things that are written to do things, you know, whether it's an FTP server or an HTTP server or whatever, really, they come sort of set up to go a lot of times. Now, not to go the way you want them to go, so there is a little bit of configuration to do. But that's not as scary as you might think, you know. There's conf files there, and they've all got comments in them, and they've all got kind of examples of sort of the default way of it, of this would be happening. So it's not that big of a deal. VSFTPD creates a conf file either in etc or in etc slash VSFTPD, and on Fedora it is in etc VSFTPD. So if you do a su space dash c single quote vim space slash etc slash VSFTPD slash VSFTPD dot conf, then that will open as root the configuration file for this. Lots of different ways to set this up, and probably the easiest way to really, really customize it will be to, well, read the comments, first of all. But also just, you know, if you go around online and look for sample configuration setups, you might be able to do that. And there are a lot of different things that are available. What I did not want in my apartment open to the world was anonymous logging in, anonymous access. So I did not allow that, and that is one of the first questions it asks you. Allow anonymous FTP. And I think the default is yes. Now, the default is also that those anonymous people can only download. But I just felt it was probably better to just, especially since I'm a noob, just not have anonymous FTP at all. So I did that. And that kind of cancels out a whole bunch of the questions about anonymous users. So the one thing that I did uncomment was local underscore enable, meaning that the local users get to log in. Okay, so this is not necessarily all the time a default, I guess, but that's what I want, is local users to be able to log in. Now, if it's a local user, they must have a user account on that computer, correct? So they'll have a username and they'll have their password. So if they were going to sit in front of the computer and log on, that would be exactly what they're going to use to log in via FTP. So it's almost just like giving someone an SSH account, which admittedly might have been a good idea as well. My concern was if it would be slower to transfer, especially like from Germany, via SSH 42 gigabyte video files rather than just doing it FTP. And especially since this is just a temporary installation, I'm not going to keep this FTP server around forever. It just needs to get the files, and then I'm going to close it off. I'm going to actually even delete the account that was permitted. So everything's going to go away once I have these video files. There are other things about log files and stuff like that. I figured I'd keep those enabled because probably good for me to see what's going on. And, of course, I have to look at them, too. You know, I mean, it's one thing to have log files, and it's quite another to ignore the fact that they're there. So I'm really making a mental note to myself that I need to keep an eye on that, make it a point to actually see what's going on with the log files and stuff. So really the only customization I did, as you hear, was that I disabled anonymous access and I enabled local user access. Now, if we're just doing local user stuff, then we need to create these local users an account. And so since I knew exactly where my files were coming from, I did a user I just did su and then put in my root password. As root, I did a user add space dash d slash media slash external hard drive slash KDE, okay? So what that did was I added a user, I defined its home directory as something actually on an external hard drive. I need a very big external hard drive because the computer I'm doing this on does not have a very large hard drive. So I got a 300 gigabyte, which, you know, I mean, that's not very large, but it's large enough for the for what I need, plugged it into the computer, and this is an older computer, so actually it wouldn't power like one of those small, like sort of normal size hard drives, you know, those little passports by Western Digital and stuff like that, those ones that you can kind of fit in your pocket. They're about the size of a Nokia N800 or so. So I had to get like this old hard drive that I had, and it's as big as a book, and it's like only 300 gigabytes, but that was all I needed. But I mean, it was kind of a pain, because then I had to find power for that external hard drive. But the advantage there was that it was a FireWire drive as well, so the transfer, I guess, will be a little bit faster, a little bit in that sense, because the USB ports were just, like, way too slow. Anyway, yeah, so this is, I mean, just to mention, I mean, this is a PowerPC G4 Apple computer that I've got this going on, so it's kind of cool. So I've got user add. I did the -d to the /media/external hard drive, we'll call it, /KDE, meaning that I made a directory there called KDE. And that doesn't make a directory. I'd have to actually go in and make the directory myself, you know, mkdir/media/KDE. And then I named the user KDE. So simple enough. Now I need to define a password for that user. So passwd /KDE, and then it asks me to type in a password for that person. I came up with a very long and complex and confusing and strange password. This is facing the outside world. At this point, people will have access to this. People can hit this up and try to guess the password and all that other good stuff. So I figured I'd better make it good. And that's what I did, and now it's pretty much set up in terms of the actual FTP server software is ready to go. I've got the local users set up to get access into this thing. Now what I need to do is punch a hole in the firewall. So on Fedora, they give you a firewall application, front-end firewall application, which is a good thing because I have no idea how to use IP tables. So what I did was I opened up FTP access in the computer's little firewall. So this isn't on my router or anything like that, right? This is on the computer. So I said, yes, computer, listen in on port 21, which is the default FTP. I think it's the first screen in there, actually, called Trusted Ports, shows you a list of the typical ports that you may want to have either open or blocked off or whatever. And one of them up at the top is going to be 21, which is the FTP port. You want to enable that one and then save your settings. And it will warn you, and first of all, it will ask you for your root password to make sure you have permission to do this sort of thing. And then it will warn you. It will tell you that you are opening up your firewall. Are you sure you want to do this? In this case, yes, you want to do this. You're still probably behind your router's firewall, so you're actually still not open to the outside world, plus you haven't even started your VSFTP server yet, actually. We haven't started the service, but we're on the way, so make sure you're wanting to do this. I punched that hole in the firewall. Now the computer is listening on port 21. Now we want to step out and go to the router and figure that one out. Lots of different issues here, because obviously there's a lot of different routers out there. So this is usually, in my limited support experience, where people get kind of hung up. I mean, I know I've gotten hung up here. A couple of different ways to do it. Now, if this is a computer, a dedicated box that's just going to be doing FTP, there's literally nothing else on that computer. It's a clean install of Fedora 12, and there's just nothing on there. So it doesn't really matter much to me. I'm just using it basically as an FTP server right now so that I can get these video files. So what I did was actually place it physically outside of the router. Like, I didn't plug it into my router. I'm plugging it straight into a dedicated line that's going out into the internet. And I just happened to have that because I recently switched away from Comcast to a different local provider, ISP. So I had the Comcast service still active because they won't shut it off until they come and physically pick up the equipment. So it's still online. I mean, so basically for like 2 weeks I have two internet connections, which conveniently works out really, really nicely for me. So there's no router on between the Comcast modem and this computer. So I simply plugged it in, and now it's in essentially a demilitarized zone, or a DMZ. Now, if you've got not two internet connections, like normally, I don't think normally people do, and certainly I don't usually, then you're going to have to either punch a hole in your router's firewall or place your computer virtually outside of that router firewall. So on your router, you're going to either go to some tab or some section called access or firewall or port forwarding or something like that, and tell it to listen to port 21 and forward port 21 onto your computer's internal IP address. Meaning that you're going to say, anything coming in to me on port 21, I want you to actually go ahead and listen to it and send it on, pass it on through to computer 192.168.0.4 or whatever your computer internal IP address is. And if you don't know that, become root in Fedora or Slackware or whatever you're using this on, and do an ifconfig and look at your settings in ifconfig, and you'll see an IP address there. It will probably start with either a 10.0.0 something or a 192.168.x.x. Look for that. That's your IP address. And you're going to have everything coming in on port 21 into the router forwarded to your computer. And then your computer, of course, is listening on port 21, so it's going to pick up that signal and say, hey, I've got an FTP signal. Well, why don't I ask for a username and a password? And that's how it works. Now, I do that all the time with SSH, so I know that that works on my router quite well, and I know how to do it. I don't know how to do it on your router, so you might have to figure that one out. But in terms of getting the signal from the outside world in through your firewall, that's where it needs to happen, probably on your router. Now, the other option is, and I would hesitate to do this unless it's a dedicated box, but you can basically sort of, it's called a demilitarized zone, meaning that it is outside of the firewall. You still plug the computer into the router, but for that IP address, and for that IP address alone, 192.168.0.4, for instance, we're saying don't have a firewall up. Just let everything hit this computer, which obviously is kind of dangerous sounding, and it probably is, but that is what I would have done if I hadn't had the Comcast line by pure coincidence coming into my apartment, as well as my other ISP coming in. So, in fact, I did that originally, and I felt like it was going a little bit slow and stuff like that, so I switched over to the Comcast. So you can do that, and it works, and you just say, okay, here's my computer IP address, and you find in your router where it talks about a DMZ. Sometimes they might call it, like, virtual server or something like that, so you want to place that computer's IP address into the DMZ. Save that on your router, and so now your computer is kind of like, it's out there. Now, we still haven't started the FTP service yet, which I guess we might as well go ahead and do. So as root, you're going to want to issue the command /etc/init.d/vsftpd /start, and you should get a green OK. You should, if it says fail or something like that, then, well, it failed, and you want to make sure that all your settings are correct and stuff. I've never had a problem with it so far. Set it up, and you say /etc/init.d/vsftpd start, and it starts. And that you have to do that as root. Again, you don't get to do that as a regular user. Okay, so now your computer is an FTP server, and it's looking out at the world and listening on port 21 for incoming traffic. The thing that you need to do now is figure out where to tell people to find your computer, because you probably don't have, like, a static IP address or anything like that, so you probably don't have, like, a domain name associated with your house. Now, you might have an internal domain name, but you need something that the world knows how to find. Easiest way to do this, especially for a temporary kind of setup, is simply go to whatsmyip.org and find out what the outside world sees your computer as in terms of, like, IP address. So it might be 62.100.52.13. It might be 76.120.120.2. It could be anything. It'll kind of depend on who your ISP is and what area you're in and all this other good stuff. But that's it. And so then if you go out to the library or something or to work and test this out and go into FTP and do open whatever that IP address was, like 62.120.120.120, and then it should ask you for a username and a password, and you should be able to log in with that local user. Remember, we set up one called KDE, and the password was a big, long, complicated password. So you do that, say okay, and it should just dump you into /media/external hard drive/KDE. And it's that simple. Now, I ran into a couple of problems. One was that I forgot to set permissions on the external hard drive correctly. So you need to make sure that the local user has read and write access to that external hard drive. This hard drive was something that I pulled off of a back part of a shelf. I'd forgotten about it. I formatted it, but I don't know what I did exactly, but the permissions just were not right. So I went in as root and owned the whole hard drive, basically, because it's empty. Gave it over to user KDE. KDE group KDE for Fedora, because they always create that special group for the users, for each individual user. So chown-R KDE:KDE/media/external hard drive. And that switched over the permissions. Now KDE had read and write and execute permission over that hard drive. Much, much better. Then you can also run into problems with SE Linux. And this is tough. And like I say, at work, at one of my current jobs, I was able to do some kind of command where I set access to FTP as being okay. I didn't seem to be able to do that from home, and I didn't have the command in front of me, and I wanted to get this thing up and running for all the KDE people ready to dump a whole bunch of video onto my computer. So I simply went into SE Linux settings and just turned it off. Normally, I wouldn't do that, and I don't really love that I did it. It really was an ungraceful solution, but like I say, I had people waiting to do this, so I didn't want to keep them waiting while I was trying to find this command. And unfortunately, I have no idea where this magical command got off to, and so I may never find it again. I think it was something like SE bool equals FTP, or enable_FTP, or something bizarre like that. And the reason I don't have the command anymore is because it was something that actually the SE Linux troubleshooter suggested to me. So if you get this error and you're on Fedora 12, you will actually, when you try to, someone tries to log in, and it will fail with an error, I think 500 is what I was getting from the last known god, then SE Linux will actually pop up in your system tray, and you can click on it, and it will tell you, hey, you've had something unauthorized has been trying to access something, and it will actually suggest the command that you can issue to enable that. And so if you issue that command in your terminal as root, that will basically punch a hole in SE Linux, saying it's okay for people to try to access FTP. And it's just a Boolean switch. It's an on and off. You know, right now it's off, you need to turn it on. So it's pretty simple, and it literally does it for you. It didn't do it for me on this install, because I think I was just not paying attention. I know that SE Linux did pop up, and there were two commands suggested for me, and I didn't do it, and then I lost it, and I wasn't paying attention, and I was in a hurry, so that just didn't happen. But happily, SE Linux makes it pretty easy because of SE Linux Troubleshooter, and you can just issue a command, and it will open that up for you. And aside from that, that's it. A couple of things to look out for. Like I say, look at your logs. Don't ignore those. That's not smart. And then the other thing, plus log files can actually get quite big, as someone was pointing out to me. I mean, if you just ignore the log files, someone could be attacking your computer, not getting in or anything, but just barraging it with attempts, and it's being logged. It logs all this stuff. And as actually Gort told me a while ago, back when he had a Linux server facing the outside world, there was a point where his log files, you know, they were just getting such a lot of requests that it filled up an entire partition of just logs because he didn't look at it forever. And that's how he learned how to look at log files. So yeah, it's good to do that. And then the other thing to keep in mind, which I also didn't do at first, was make sure you have plenty of space. If you anticipate getting a whole bunch of stuff, which is what I'm getting, like lots of uncompressed interviews from like technical conferences and stuff, you need to have a lot of space allotted for this. And definitely make sure that you've got a hard drive that's going to be able to handle the amount of video or the amount of files that you anticipate. Very important. Otherwise, that's it. I mean, that's about it. So give it a shot if you want to. It's really a handy trick to know, and it's really quite satisfying when you start seeing files appear from people in Germany and stuff. It's kind of cool.
If I could just make a decent cup of coffee, I could relax.
A great coffee.
So the Speaks feed, like I say, it's alive and well. Have no fear. I'm not getting rid of it. It's not going away. It is quite nice. And these Speaks files are really, really small. And they sound terrible. They're just like the worst quality, aren't they? Well, that's because Speaks is designed for low, low bandwidth and low bit rate and sample rate. Specifically, it's designed for three different sample rates. There's 8,000 hertz, there's 16,000 hertz, and then there's double that, 32,000 hertz. I could never remember what it was until I realized it was 8 times 2 and then, or 8 times 1 and then 8 times 2 and then 8, or I guess really, you know, 16 times 2. Actually pretty easy. And as long as you give speaks, or rather, the program speaks ENC, speaks inc, that's speaks encoder, right? So as long as you give speaks encoder a file that is a sample rate 8,000 or 16,000 or 32,000 hertz, otherwise sometimes known as 8 kilohertz, 16 kilohertz, 32 kilohertz, then it's going to be able to process those fairly easily. And the processing that it does is defined by a couple of different parameters, and I recently spent a lot of time playing around with these parameters. So what I did was I wrote a little bash script, which is not sophisticated at all. It's literally just a batch process, because I didn't know how to do fancy things like for file in, you know, $1/, you know, all that other good stuff like a real pro could do. But I did just issue basically the same command with different settings over and over and over again. And I just took a variety of different things. There are music files, my own show, just human voice files, all those things, and they were at different sample rates, 32,000, 16,000, 8,000, and I had speaks ENC, speaks encoder, encode them at different quality settings, different complexity settings, different bitrate settings, and a couple of different options that they give you aside from that. And I wanted to see what it did for file size and for sound quality. The other variable there, of course, is encoding time, but I didn't really care about encoding time. Plus, I forgot to issue it with the time flag anyway, so good thing I didn't care. But these were all really kind of small files anyway, so timing it I don't think would have been all that significant. But sometimes when you're doing like render tests and stuff like that, you do care about time, and that would be something to pay attention to. It turns out that Speaks ENC encoder, well, first of all, it's designed for really, really low bit rates, so that you've got, like on a DVD or something, you've got bit rates of 7,000, 8,000 kilobits per second. That's pretty good. And that's just a standard definition DVD. And it's pretty big, and it's pretty good quality. For Speaks, we're talking about a lot lower than that. 4.8 kilobits per second was one of the examples that they gave in the manual of the Speaks codec itself. 16 kilobits per second. Compare that to, like I say, a DVD, which is sending 7,000, 8,000 kilobits per second. Completely, we're in a different ballpark, you know, it's not even the same sport. And the sample rate is expressed in hertz or kilohertz, depending on how you want to speak about it. Speaks can go with 8, 16, or 32 kilohertz. Anything different than that is going to give it some problems. The slang terms for these is narrowband, wideband, and ultra-wideband. So if you see messages from Speaks encoder or decoder, then you see them about narrowband, wideband, ultra-wideband. That's just 8, 16, and 32, respectively. The bitrate itself can be, like I say, really, really high, really, really low, and it's all relative, because what they talk about really high is really, really low in real life, comparatively compared to other things. It's tiny. And this is because Speaks is really, really dedicated towards speech. It is for the human voice talking. That is what it can do well. Speaks is obviously a lossy codec. I don't think I probably even had to say that, but yes, it is. This is obviously really good because you can control, you can kind of control the quality, but you can really, you can have all kinds of control over the bit rate. And you can say, okay, I want a constant bit rate that's just going to keep going and give me the same quality no matter what's going on, or I can have a variable bit rate, which is nice because the variable bit rate can do cool things like drop the bit rate really, really, really down low on easy to reproduce sounds like S's and F's and things like that, but then it's going to pump up the bit rate when really complex sounds are being uttered, like vowels and other sounds like that, which have a lot of different, you know, if you looked at the sound wave of those require a lot more kind of calculation than something that's fairly flat. So that's what VBR will kind of give you the advantage with there. It also has voice activity detection, which is nice because that way if someone goes silent, for instance, on a phone call, like a VoIP call or something like that, which is what Speaks is often used for, it will actually be able to drop its bitrate way, way down because there's silence, and it can actually kind of tell that it's silence rather than voice sound. So it kind of has a little bit of noise detection. You know, it kind of knows noise. It knows noise from signal to some degree. Now, the voice activity detection implies VBR, variable bitrate, because obviously then if it's dropping the bitrate during silence, then obviously that's giving you a variable bitrate. So if you're using voice activity detection, VAD, then you are also getting VBR. So the Speaks codec itself obviously is free. It's completely free software. It doesn't have patent or royalty baggage associated with it. It can do the three different sample rates. It has a wide range of bit rates available to it, anywhere from technically 2.15 kilobits per second up to, I think they say in the manual, 44 kilobits per second. I mean, it's shocking how small this stuff is. It's really, really small stuff. They do a little bit of, like I say, a little bit of denoising and stuff like that. So it's quite a nice little codec, kind of a, you know, very mysterious to me because I don't know how codecs are literally written, but I certainly know how they act typically. And the way they act is revealed, like I say, through tests. And so I did a series of tests on a wide variety of different kinds of media. So I had voice only. I had music and voice in the same file, but not together. I had music, and then I had music and voice in the same file overlapping, actually a person speaking with voice, with music in the background. Those were my test files. And there are a couple of different typical variables that you're going to kind of hear about when you're looking at Speaks ENC. So the Speaks, the codec, is of course a codec. You don't really interact with it directly, but it does come with two little applications, Speaks ENC, which is Speaks Encoder, and Speaks DEC, which is Speaks Decoder. So in order to get a Speaks file, one of the easiest ways is to use Speaks ENC. And as I've said on a previous show, because Ken Fallon emailed me and told me about it, was that Speaks ENC is also a pipeable thing where you can send the output of one application straight into Speaks ENC, and it will treat that as the input file. So that's kind of cool. And I mentioned that like two or three episodes ago for the exact command. So Speaks ENC will give you a couple of different options. And the important options, I suppose, are quality, so that's dash dash quality, bitrate, dash dash bitrate, VBR, dash dash VBR, dash dash comp, COMP, as in complexity, and there's dash dash denoise as well. So quality, bitrate, and complexity are the really big ones when you're talking about what you hear when you're listening to the Speaks file. The quality setting goes from 0 to 10, and it seems to be the most important switch that you can set. If you're going to set one switch in this whole thing, quality would be the one to actually look at. By default, it's set at 8, which isn't that bad, but it really depends on what you're shooting for. Obviously, the higher your quality, the heavier your file size is going to be. So you may or may not want that. I have played around with things as low as 0 quality. And frankly, for voice only, it actually works fairly well. More often than not, you're probably going to want to not totally make your audience hate you. Go more with like a quality of 1 or 2, or maybe even 3. You're still going to get a tiny file size. I'm talking tiny. I think the expression would be orders of magnitude. I mean, I couldn't get files to be anywhere near their original file size with Speaks. I tried pumping up the quality to 10, the complexity to 10, setting the bitrate high, just everything I could try to possibly think of, and I just couldn't get anywhere near the original file size. So Speaks is going to give you something small, more or less whether you like it or not. If you're trying to get a really high quality sound at a big file size, Speaks is not the way to go. If you want flexibility and get a small file size, this is a great little codec. Quality is the most important thing. 0 is pretty bad. 1 is pretty bad. 3 starts to get pretty nice sounding, really. I took it all the way up to 7 and figured that was as good as it was going to get. But actually, quality 10 really, I mean, it sounds really nice and it's really acceptable for both music and speech. Music starts to fall apart horribly at around quality 3. Quality 3, it'll play the music, but it sounds like noise, practically. At 0, it is noise. It's just, it's not even, it doesn't even maintain the musical notes, almost. It's just sort of staticky representation that there is that there was music there at one point. But around quality 3, music starts to kind of fall apart. So if you've got music in the file, you probably don't want to dip any lower than 3. And frankly, if you don't want to annoy your audience, you probably want to keep it around quality 5. Now, complexity, and this is the thing that they don't really explain, one of the things they don't really explain in the manual, the complexity seems to have something to do with, I'm going to guess it's kind of like either the samples that they're kind of like averaging out, that they're kind of reducing, or it's got something to do with the actual frequencies that they're cutting off. Samples, if you don't know, you can imagine it, like if you zoom all the way into a sample, you can imagine it as kind of like one of those little bitmapped painting, you know, like old dot matrix computers, or printers, dot matrix printers, or, you know, just where it's like pixmaps, bitmaps rather. You got pixel per pixel representation of something, and if you zoom in close enough, rather than a rounded corner, you'll see the little pixels, right? Well, samples are a little bit like that, and the more samples you have in your sound, so if you've got like 44,100 samples per seconds or whatever you're measuring it by, then you've got really nice smooth sample, and if you zoom in, it would look nice. There would be a lot of little tiny samples in there making all of these sound waves. That's the sample rate. Now if you knock that down to, oh, I don't know, 8,000 hertz or 16,000 hertz, you're starting to zoom in and you're starting to really, really see those jagged edges on those sound wave representations, and that's why it sounds so bad. So I'm guessing that complexity is kind of how much they are, I'm guessing that it's how much they shave off those little samples, like how pixelated they let those sound waves become in the samples. I could be wrong about that. It could have something to do with just how much, you know, what the frequencies that they're chopping out are. It could be that. But to my ear, it sounds more like a sample thing. That's my guess. And I guess they're related, so it's probably, I'm probably either right on both or more or less right about neither. I don't know. So the point is, that's the complexity, I think. And the complexity alone doesn't really have a whole lot of effect. For instance, if you encode something at quality 0, but pump up the complexity to like 10, you're not actually gaining a whole lot. Your quality is still reducing something really, really badly. Again, the manual doesn't exactly say what that is. It just seems to be a broad spectrum of things. It's probably taking out samples. It's probably taking out frequencies. It's doing all that good stuff. Whereas the complexity, I think, is working with what quality gives it and either is doing more or less depending on how you set it. So if you want a really nice sounding file that's still going to be fairly small, you could set your quality up to like 7 and your complexity up to 10, and you're going to have a really nice sounding file. And frankly, the size does not increase that much. I'm going to start using complexity more. I hadn't been using it before all these tests, but I think that actually setting complexity up to 10 is going to render a nicer sounding file at very, very little file increase. It doesn't seem to do much for the file size at all. Now, the issue of VBR or -VAD, now, like I say, -VAD equals VBR, so you might as well use one or the other. I just use VBR. VBR is nice. It's nice for everything. Variable bitrate. What it does is let the encoder look at the data that you're feeding it and figure out for itself where it needs to really be high in its bitrate versus where it needs to be really low. And so, like I said, the manual specifies literally the sounds that the human voice is making, where the bitrate can either dip down to something ridiculously low or kind of favor the higher bitrate settings of the Speaks codec. This is a good thing, and very rarely is it not a good thing. And so I typically set it at VBR because what you get is the ability for the encoder to keep your file size small because it can make up for that one area in the thing where it needed to be a higher bitrate by cutting down to a lower bitrate here and here and here where you're not really talking that much, or where you've stopped talking entirely, where you're pausing and stuff like that. So VBR is typically good, and I admit that it didn't have the profound effect I had hoped for. I mean, on video files, if you set it for variable bitrate, it's really, really profoundly noticeable. Speaks, it wasn't quite that noticeable. But then again, I couldn't ever get my file size anywhere above like 15 megabytes for one of my podcasts. 50 minutes of audio coming in at 15 megabytes. And that was like at max settings for everything. So where am I going to see the file size savings, I guess is my point. But I'm still probably going to be using VBR because I know that it typically helps out a lot, because because then, you know, in the areas that it does need to jump up a little bit, it has the freedom to do that. Now, you can also override, you know, you can say, okay, no VBR, and here's my bit rate. Here's the maximum bit rate that I want you to work at. However, what that does not do is force everything to be at that bit rate. It is a maximum bit rate setting. I tried many times to get speaks to encode at really, really high bit rates. But all that was saying, as I learned after I read the manual, was that do not exceed that bit rate. That's the maximum bit rate. The summary, I guess, the cheat sheet would be: quality is the average quality of the file, and it seems to be kind of the first filter set in place. The quality that you give it is going to affect everything thereafter. The complexity feeds off of the quality. Whatever the quality filter, as it were, has put through. So far, that's what the complexity seems to deal with, and it kind of adds to or subtracts from the quality. The bit rate, like I say, is something that you can really only set as sort of a limit or mainly a limit. You know, you don't go above this bit rate, essentially, is what it's going to do. And even if you set it at a high bit rate, when it does go lower, it's going to go lower. It's not going to maintain a constant bit rate in any way, as far as I can tell. You can set an average bit rate with the ABR switch, and I think it's --ABR. I think all of them are --. Let me just verify that. Yeah, it's --ABR. And --ABR will at least give you a bit rate that you want it to float around. You know, you want it to maintain that as an average. There are obviously other switches, and I could go into all of them and talk about them for ages, but I'm not going to. Input files always were WAV files, and they were always at either 8,000, 16,000, or 32,000 hertz, and that's about it, I think. So those were my findings, and hopefully they give you a little bit of an idea of what Speaks can do and what it does well. There's no time that I was overly impressed with Speaks' performance with music. It's just not meant for that sort of thing. It's meant for from what I'm gathering from the manual and everything, it's meant for the rhythms and the variation in a human voice and something speaking with vowels and consonants and plosives and fricatives, and that's what it does. Music doesn't happen like that, and it's not quite the same, and so it just doesn't handle that as well. Doesn't handle that gracefully at all. So if you can avoid music in your Speaks file, I think that would be best. I mean, you can get around it. You can set your quality high and then set your complexity high, but then you're obviously giving up a lot of the control over how small you can make that file, right? Because now you're suddenly having to make your entire file, you're setting your quality that high because of that two or three seconds of music that you have at the intro and the outro. So you're killing a lot of flexibility there. And that's it, I guess. Well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Speaks is the codec, and the container format that it is put into is OGG. So Speaks is an OGG, it's fit into an OGG container. But the codec itself is Speaks. So far I've been able to play that with a couple of different applications and then on my Rockbox. The application that I usually use to play on the computer is FFPlay, which is a part of the FFmpeg package. I like FFPlay because it's just kind of simple and just plays stuff, but you could use other stuff as well. And then Rockbox is what I use for playback on the go. I think that's about it. That's it for the Speaks thing, and actually that's it for the show. So thanks for listening. Of course, I'm Klaatu, and my email address is klaatu@member.fff.org. That's my new official email address. Well, my other new official email address was klaatu@hackrepublicradio.org. Well, that's always an official one. So those are the two email addresses, klaatu@member.fff.org or klaatu@hackrepublicradio.org. Now, you can find me on Jabber if you like to IM. So that would be notklaatu@jabber.org. And then you can find me on IRC. On the Freenode network, irc.freenode.net. My nick on there is not Klaatu, so you should be able to find me. The website, of course, is klaatu.hackrepublicradio.org, and this has been episode 8 of season 5. Thanks for listening.
You'll see very soon.